racism, xenophobia, and homophobia across the globe. That's one heart, one fight, one sisterhood. Visioning justice, freedom, peace, and security for the women of the world. Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hello, I'm Dr. E. Faye Williams, National Chair of the National Congress of Black Women. And you're tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
Little mention of bringing down prices or even Gaza. DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. It's not a synonym for Black. Dr. Barbara Emerson unpacks the real definition of DEI. And if you're experiencing economic anxiety, is now the time to file bankruptcy? And if not now, when? Good morning, good morning, good morning, and welcome to What's at Stake. I am Verna Avery Brown. Well, the president gave his first congressional speech of his second term last night, and as expected, Republican lawmakers cheered and jumped to their feet in ovations consistently throughout the two-hour rally. Democrats sat stone-faced, some waving small signs that said lies at various points, but Representative Al Green of Texas shouted at the president and waved his brass-handled cane, causing the speaker to have him removed by security early on as Republicans cheered from the other side of the aisle. Throughout the speech, other Democrats made an early exit, among them Texas Representative Jasmine Crockett, Florida Representative Maxwell Frost, Massachusetts Representative Ayanna Pressley, Maryland Representative Jamie Raskin, Maryland Senator Chris Holland, and Oregon Representative Maxine Dexter. It's unclear how his speech played in homes across America. Prior to his address, Republicans put on the brakes on holding town hall meetings in their red states after being confronted with a groundswell of disaffected and angry constituents.
You are doing us a disservice to set that down and not stand up for us.
Republicans are now hitting the brakes on in-person town halls. That's after several Republican members received quite a bit of pushback over President Trump and Elon Musk's cuts to the federal government. And that has led to viral clips, negative headlines, and overall public blowback that Republicans worry could end up costing them votes. Now, GOP aides have told us that that has led leaders to encourage their colleagues in the House to avoid this format altogether. They've even gone as far as to say that if they feel the need to have a town hall, they should do it virtually or even vet the attendees before they get in the room. But even those formats might be off the table, with one Republican lawmaker telling us that these heated exchanges have so spooked his colleagues that they might not want to do town halls at all.
And that was NBC reporter Ryan Nobles providing that report. Well, Trump says angry Republicans at town halls are paid actors. It begs the question as to why all congressional GOP lawmakers support Trump's policies at the risk of losing significant votes during midterm elections. U.S. Congresswoman from Maxine Dexter of Oregon made a shocking announcement to constituents gathered last week at a town hall gathered in Gresham, Oregon. According to David McAfee of Raw Story, Dexter reportedly told constituents that Republican lawmakers are in lockstep with Donald Trump in part because they are receiving death threats. According to UT farming commentator Park Rose Permaculture, who attended the PAC Dexter town hall, Dexter said, quote, there are Republicans who, when they think of stepping out of line, they get a call from the president, end quote. According to the report, Dexter said, quote, they are getting death threats, Park Rose Permaculture wrote in a follow-up post on the social media platform Blue Sky. If so many GOPs in Congress are truly getting death threats, their families, that why aren't they recording the calls, putting them together, and releasing them all to the public? Meanwhile, Elon Musk, undeterred by criticism, continues his slash and burn actions across the federal government and calls Social Security a, quote, Ponzi scheme when interviewed Friday on the Joe Rogan podcast. Musk, who the president identified last night as the head of DOGE, insists he's only focusing on fraud, waste, and abuse in Social Security. And Trump last night lied about there being people on the Social Security rolls being paid who are 300 years old. The former head of the Social Security Administration, Martin O'Malley, sounded the alarm over the Department of Government Efficiency's cost-cutting measures, warning that the Social Security Administration could, quote, collapse within the next 30 to 90 days. Trump did not promise not to cut Social Security last night. O'Malley told CNBC on Saturday that with the cuts in funding and staffing, without intervention, the system could face a full breakdown. Ultimately, he said, you're going to see the system collapse and there will be an interruption of benefits. I think that will happen within the next 30 to 90 days, he said. And Trump did not promise to keep hands off Social Security in his two-hour address. More than 72.5 million Americans rely on Social Security for benefits. People should start saving now, urged O'Malley. The highly publicized fiasco between Trump, J.D. Vance, and Zelensky last week has been labeled everything from an ambush to a mafia-style intimidation to a day that will live in infamy. And although Trump said it would make good TV, his ratings were not, I'm sure, what he had hoped for. The majority of Americans in a CNN poll following the exchange gave Trump an unfavorable rating. 52% disapprove of his performance so far, 39% think the country is on the right track, and 15%, they just don't know. During his address, Trump spent scant time on Ukraine, repeating lies about the amount of assistance the U.S. has provided and hinted that he's gotten strong signals from Russia that Putin is ready for peace. Meanwhile, more than 30,000 federal workers have been given notice by DOGE. Maryland Governor Wes Moore has been preparing for a second Trump term since February and announced a newly created website with 130,000 job openings, as well as resources for housing and programs for veterans. In-person job fairs are scheduled for Friday in Prince George's County in Baltimore. Moore was actually appointed by Trump to the President's Governors Association, but after spending several days in Washington with the president, Governor Moore declined to join the group, saying he will work with anyone but will bow down to no one. Well, the president opened his address listing some of the MAGA favorite executive orders he signed in week one, including a series of executive orders targeting diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI programs. DEI has erroneously become somewhat of a synonym for Black, a code for affirmative action, or an individual hired because they're a minority or female or both, and not hired for their merits or qualifications to do the job. Our guest this morning is Dr. Barbara Williams Emerson. She's the daughter of civil rights activist, Reverend Hosea Williams, one of Dr. Martin Luther King's trusted generals in the fight for civil rights. Dr. Barbara Williams Emerson cut her teeth in the movement, so to speak, but as an activist, academic leader and consultant in her own right, Dr. Emerson is well-versed on the subject of DEI and will offer her perspective on how Trump's executive order is playing out actually in America today. Welcome, Dr. Barbara Williams Emerson. Thank you for joining us on What's at Stake.
Thank you for having me this morning.
So in full disclosure, I worked for your father, Reverend Hosea Williams at SCLC in Atlanta early in my career.
I see.
It was an adventure.
I'm sure.
So, Dr. Emerson, what exactly does DEI or diversity, equity, and inclusion, what does that policy require a federal agency to do?
What did it require or what does it now require?
What did it require?
Well, it required agencies to make sure that they had a diverse, meaning that they their workforce had its it had a mandate to carry out diversity and to make sure that they were doing their work in such a way that it included women and people of color in their agenda, and that it carried out diversity and equity as a part of what they were doing.
Did it also include people with handicaps?
Disabilities. Disabilities, mm-hmm. And that it was not discriminating against anyone for their characteristics in the execution of their responsibilities to the public and to the responsibilities that it carried out towards the government, and that it made an effort to see to it that
disabilities.
It did so in an equitable and inclusive way.
So it was they were mandated. Would there have been consequences had they not had that type of created that type of a work environment?
Yes. And that is, you see, what it was doing was carrying, there's been a long history in the United States, and in it's what I call the pendulum of diversity, inclusion, and equity. It's not the first time that this has been tried. It works in all institutions. There are what I call incidents of awareness, appreciation, and alignment that all kinds of institutions face periodically. It's a pendulum that mm-hmm. swings back and forth, and we've called it different things. Right now, it's being called diversity, equity, and inclusion.
Was it called affirmative action at one time?
It was called affirmative action. It's been called multiculturalism. It's been called civil rights over our historical involvement of trying to make this nation live. It's been called moral arc. It's been called many things. And we've tried to get this right several times. Mm-hmm. And it seems that we haven't been able to do it. We have these moments of awareness that we have to try to keep doing it. We get shocked by these moments of awareness. Mm. We face these moments. We're coming up on the anniversary, the 60th anniversary of one in a couple of days, Bloody Sunday. That was a moment of awareness. Mm-hmm. We were shocked into action by the attack of Jose Williams and John Lewis and others on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. We were shocked into action when George Floyd was murdered in front of our eyes. So we have these moments of awareness, and we get shocked into action about doing something about the way that our country lives a life of oppression. Mm. And then we go we were shocked when Emmett Till was murdered, and we did something about it, and we had the 1957 Civil Rights mm-hmm. Act. And so we have these moments of awareness, and we get shocked, and oh my God, and we look in the mirror and we see the mm-hmm. ugliness of what we do. And then we come and we have acts of appreciation for how we must do better. Mm-hmm. And we have these acts of appreciation, and we have the 1957 Civil Rights Act, or we have the Voting Rights Act of 1965, or we have all of the affirmative of the diversity, the DEI initiatives mm-hmm. of the ones that are in place now, or the ones that Target picked up, or the government picked up after George Floyd. But we don't, just let me finish this mm-hmm. this, and I think I can explain where we are. But What we don't do is to move to the final phase of alignment, of actually aligning our institutional processes with what we say we're about. Mm. We get up to the point of diversity, of affirmative action, of civil rights. We never actually put into action into the institutional fiber of the government, of the or of the hospital, of the educational system, those things which we say will make it right. So we cut off the DIE initiatives before they give birth to the outcomes mm-hmm. that would make it right. And okay. That's where we are now.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to say. Has there ever been a point in history, Dr. Emerson, where the policies that were in place were actually banned and abandoned the way President Trump has done with his executive order on DEI?
No. We make these policies get made every 60, 70 years. We make the policies and then we get on the wheel and we start running and running and running and then we stop. Hmm. Because the pendulum swings to the right and we get to the right and we go, oh, we've gone too far. We had a Black president. Oh, we've gone too far. You know, mm-hmm. we passed the Civil Rights Act and we elected all of these Black officials as a result of passing the of the Voting Rights Act. We've gone too far. And it then starts swinging back to the right.
Mm. So
we ride it so far to the left. We've gone too far. We never reach the point of institutionalizing our moral commitment. Mm. We never really align our country, our institutions, our churches, our schools. We never go all the way to making the commitment that we say we are about, as far as it goes to making everybody equal.
Hmm. So the conservative narrative is that DEI has basically unfairly led to the hiring of unqualified employees getting hired because of their race or gender. What is the truth about how DEI actually plays out in American hires? And who benefits the most from DEI, Dr. Emerson?
Usually it's white women, because they are the ones who are in numbers who benefit the most, and white families benefit the most. And it is rarely it's Black men or men of color. Sometimes it's proportionately in terms of people of color. Sometimes it's women of color. It's not men of color. It's usually because the scale that we're trying to balance, the field that we're trying to even, the group that is usually has the upper hand is white males. So if we're using people who have the opposite of disabilities, the abled, that group are able-bodied white men. And so the people that benefit the most are their counters, their counter levels, mm-hmm. and that it's white women. And they are counted in diversity, in equalizing, because gender is one of those issues that is counted mm-hmm. in terms of diversity.
You know, I think when we think of a DEI hire, it's sort of a intangible, unspoken stigma cast upon every Black person in a high or a coveted position that he or she was selected over more qualified whites because they needed to fill a DEI quota. Is that something you've noticed, or is that just my imagination, Dr. Anderson?
I don't think it's your imagination. I have not noticed it because I've chosen not to notice it. I mean, I've been the vice president of two universities in New York, and I'm sure it was thought about me, but I've chosen not to notice it because I knew it was absolutely not true. You know, I have hired people, and I have known that the people that I have hired when they were, quote unquote, when I've never called anybody a diversity hire. I've hired people because their diversity was an additional asset, mm-hmm. because they brought that as an additional value to the table, because I already had a qualified group of white males. What the diversity of having an Asian male or an Asian female that brought their knowledge of that part of the world's experience to the table was an asset. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't because they were an Asian person, it was because they had a knowledge of that part of the world that none of the rest of us had at the table.
I see. So I want to switch gears a little bit. Exactly 60 years ago, this Sunday marks the anniversary of a watershed moment in history. It's the anniversary, as you mentioned, of Bloody Sunday, when the march across the Edmund Pettus Bridge took place. Dr. Barbara Williams Emerson, your father, Reverend Hosea Williams, was on that bridge. In fact, he was on the front line alongside the late Congressman John Lewis. Yes. And we've heard the story of that horrific event from the perspective of a young John Lewis, but tell us the Hosea Williams perspective. Did your father sustain beatings as well? What can you tell us about that day from Reverend Williams' perspective?
Well, that day started off with Hosea and other members of the SCLC staff making a call to Dr. King, who was in the pulpit at Ebenezer Church, convincing him that the march should take place, although he was not there, because they had been in preparation for it based on the murder of a young man in Alabama and the people being prepared to march. And so they went ahead with the march, and of the SCLC staff, executive staff who were there, Hosea was chosen to lead the march. John Lewis and a carload of SNCC staff, SNCC staff had decided they were not going to participate in the march, but John Lewis and a carload of other SNCC workers literally went rogue and drove to Montgomery that morning and decided that they were going to participate. So John joined, and they lined up with a SNCC worker and an SCLC worker side by side at the head of the march, and he and Hosea led the march across the bridge. And that's where they were attacked. And he was beaten, but he was an athlete and a veteran, and somewhat older than the other marchers and the other SCLCs. And he was able to tactically, because of his football training and because of his veterans training, mm-hmm. to protect himself.
Okay.
From the beatings better, and to preserve himself and not get injured as badly.
Well, we certainly want to acknowledge and honor the tremendous courage and sacrifice of your father and the many, many, many unnamed heroes and sheroes that marched across that bridge and faced down the Alabama state troopers, who was directed by then Governor George Wallace to stop the march into Montgomery by whatever means necessary. And they marched so that Black Americans can walk tall and unbowed today. And we owe them a huge, huge debt of gratitude. Dr. Barbara Williams Emerson, daughter of renowned civil rights activist, Reverend Hosea Williams. She's held faculty, administrative, and vice president positions at the City University of New York and the New School for Social Research, Audrey Cohen College, and the International College of the Cayman Islands. Thank you for being our guest this morning on What's at Stake, Dr. Emerson.
My pleasure.
Next, thousands of federal workers saturating the job market, new tariffs set to drive up prices, and an uncertain economy. How does one navigate these precarious economic landscapes? Is now the time to file bankruptcy, or is that too drastic an action to take? Stay with us, back in a moment, with retired bankruptcy judge Robert Gordon and the author of Unjust Debts, Professor Melissa Jacobs.
For close to 50 years, WPFW has amplified the voices, told the stories, and shared the history and culture of Black people throughout the diaspora. In short, we are Black history. Black is WPFW. Texting WPFWFM to 801-801 will help to protect this medium in the Black radical tradition so that we can continue to chronicle Black hope, sorrow, and resistance.
And on the fired, international contracts being broken, American farmers stuck with billions of tons of food intended for export, economic anxiety is spreading across the U.S. Some will have no choice but to go bankrupt. But that may or may not be the best option for everyone facing financial insecurity. Melissa B. Jacoby is a law professor at Harvard and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's the author of Unjust Debts, How Our Bankruptcy System Makes America More Unequal. Good morning, Professor Jacoby. Thank you for joining us again on What's at Stake.
Glad to be here. Good morning.
Also joining us this morning is retired bankruptcy judge of the District of Maryland, Robert A. Gordon, law school adjunct and 1972 University of Maryland Carey Law alumnus. Judge Gordon sat on the United States Bankruptcy Court for the District of Maryland for 14 years. He's a passionate and engaged teacher and learner of the law who has almost 40 years of experience as both an attorney in private practice and on the bench as a bankruptcy judge. In full disclosure, he's also vice chairman of the WPFW local station board. Good morning, Your Honor. Welcome back to What's at Stake.
Hi, how are you?
So this is the first of two segments in a series of Bankruptcy 101. And I'm really going to start with the bare basics. Because we are currently in a very unique economic climate, crisis mode for many, this is a hypothetical situation. In general, if you're a fired federal worker with very little savings and rent or mortgage to pay and no job prospects on the horizon due to this oversaturated job market, is bankruptcy a feasible plan for you? Either one of you can decide to take that question. Professor?
Jump in, Professor.
I see the judge.
I'll jump in. The way you put it, Vern, I mean, you know, if there are no other options, then yes. I mean, that's really the short answer.
Let's say this, though, of course, we can't offer legal advice, and it's a very individualized analysis, especially for me coming at it from someone who teaches and researches. But we have to remember what bankruptcy can accomplish. The thing it can do is cancel debt, change financial obligations. And even then, there are many that cannot be adjusted. It does not print money. It does not get a new job retraining. It does not give you health insurance. So many of the problems that people have, bankruptcy can be a piece of a recovery, but people often use it, and it was designed to be used really as a last resort. For people who are losing their jobs, often we see in the research that they will try everything they possibly can to avoid filing for bankruptcy because it is expensive and they have concerns about the process.
So why does the bankruptcy system exist in the first place? What is it designed to do? How does it help an individual facing a financial crisis? Judge Gordon?
Well, I mean, I like to think of it, but what I've come to learn over the years, and maybe I learned this as soon as I started learning about bankruptcy, is that it's sort of, the legal system backs up the capitalist system in many, many ways. And to a large extent, and depending upon the specific facts and specific circumstances, bankruptcy changes the rules of the game and can give individuals and certainly businesses in many instances, sort of an escape hatch from the basics of the capitalist system to make the most of. And that doesn't mean that it's gonna be a miracle outcome for everyone that files, but it does give you that opportunity. So in essence, it permits individuals and businesses to put a stop to the abilities of creditors to enforce their claims against them, and then either permanently eliminate those claims through the bankruptcy discharge. That's the other side of the big gift that bankruptcy gives, the automatic stay, which stops collection efforts. And it's always an interesting, fascinating thing to me because it's a court order that gets created by an individual filing bankruptcy instantaneously. In other words, you know, the judge is not directly involved in the initial filing, and to initiate or trigger that first phase of the relief. And then certainly for consumers, for individuals, which I guess most of our conversation is going to be limited to, it can give the gift of the bankruptcy discharge, or in the case of a Chapter 13, a new plan for dealing with their debt, and hopefully allow them to pay it off over time. So in simple terms, that's what it does, which they would not be able to do outside of bankruptcy, because for the most part, state law would, you know, give the decided edge to the creditor. And also, just the way life is, the creditors are usually going to be the ones with the, attorneys who can enforce their rights. And often you have debtors who, you know, by simple fact of their insolvency or close to insolvency, can't afford lawyers. And I think we're going to talk about that a little bit down the road. But
We are. So, Melissa, did you have anything to add to that in terms of why it was initially designed, this whole this sort of opportunity for people to, you know, get out of debt?
Bankruptcy is actually in the Constitution, the American Constitution, and it's been there since the very beginning. Now, I'm not sure anyone imagined the system we have right now. There's a lot they wouldn't have imagined right now. Mm-hmm. But the idea was that sometimes one person has many creditors, owes money to lots of people who live in different states or are spread out, and everyone wants to be paid. And if I can't pay them all, they're going to race to try to take away what little I might have. Mm-hmm. And that it would be fair to creditors as well as to the person who owes the money to have a collective process that tries to treat everybody fairly to make the best of a bad situation. So that theme, I think, has continued. The details have certainly changed over time.
Well, you said it's in the Constitution. Right now, in real time, we're seeing certain aspects of the Constitution really being challenged. Has President Trump done anything within his first couple of weeks, 3 weeks here, that would actually threaten or undermine a person attempting to file bankruptcy?
President Trump's companies have enjoyed the protection of bankruptcy themselves in the past. The one, there's a piece
about six times, right?
Well, what I think when you add it all together, and at least four for the casinos that he had, and there's research by Jonathan Lipson at Temple University that suggests that those companies did worse than other casinos all around. So we'll leave that where it is. But I think it's too early to say. There is a piece of the Department of Justice that is dedicated to overseeing the bankruptcy system. And the public has not gotten word yet if he's making changes there, if he's going to change the direction of how they enforce the law. I think for now, we have to wait and see.
I'll just add to that, that I got some semi-inside information that they've received emails to. And I don't know a lot of the detail on that, but I had a friend who called me up to tell me that, you know, they had gotten emails similar to other government. I'm talking about what Professor Jacoby just described as the arm of the Justice Department. It's called the U.S. Trustee's Office.
Mm-hmm.
And they're supposed to give oversight to the bankruptcy system almost nationwide, not quite nationwide still at this point.
What did their email say, Judge Gordon?
Something like the emails that other federal workers received about, you know, getting resignations, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want to describe it in too great detail because I haven't seen it, but, mm-hmm. you know, this was a friend of mine who, you know, decided that they're going to leave because of the impact of the email and, you know, what they believed it meant about the future possibility of them continuing to work there.
Okay.
So that doesn't directly affect the rights of debtors, but it impacts the system in an administrative sense, the same way that the shrinkage of the rest of the federal government is going to affect people that, you know.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, if there aren't people in those positions to hear the cases and make decisions, that could directly affect the debtors, could it not?
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, Judge Gordon, break down the different types of bankruptcies. You mentioned Chapter 13, I think where you can reorganize your debts and that sort of mm-hmm. thing. I know one is where you just wipe your credit clean, credit history clean, I think, Chapter 7. And one, you make arrangements to pay back your creditors. Who decides which one you can file? Is it the filer, or is it the judge, or is it someone in between?
I'll try and keep it as simple as possible. Initially, the debtors make the decision. If you don't have a lawyer, you make the decision on your own, right?
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in Maryland, you know, we had a lot of repeat filers who were sort of familiar with the benefits, but for a first-time person, you can imagine that's a pretty, you know, tough decision to make.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an attorney, then you do it in consultation with your attorney, hopefully, and hopefully they steer you in the right direction. But the bankruptcy code was significantly amended back in 2005, 2006. Under the, what I think is the mistaken, you know, seriously mistaken belief that debtors were getting away with murder and filing bankruptcy and, you know, getting rid of debt that could have been repaid to funnel debtors into Chapter 13, depending upon their personal financial circumstances as compared to the overall financial circumstances in whatever state they were filing in according to IRS standards. So in that case, if it turns out that the numbers say you should be in Chapter 13, then you would have to convert your case to Chapter 13 or suffer the dismissal of your Chapter 7 case. So at that point, you know, the court system and the administration of bankruptcy does kind of come into play to impact the decision.
Oh, I see. So you can file one way, but they look at the numbers, what, how much you make and what your debts are.
Essentially, whatever reasonable expenses for someone in your state based upon IRS standards compared to how much you make, et cetera, et cetera. If you fall below a certain number, then you would have the choice to stay in Chapter 7. If you go above that number, then the system would sort of require that you be funneled into a Chapter 13, or you can fight about it too. You can debate it. I had a couple of opinions early on when I first got on the bench back in 2006, 2007 that, you know, dealt with that issue. But so it's not entirely voluntary. You don't have the free will to choose in the way that you kind of used to in the past, when it was only subject to the judge's discretion in whatever the case law was in your circuit as to whether or not you were filing in a way that would abuse the system, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. So if someone came while you were sitting on the bench, if someone came filing a Chapter 7 and their numbers indicated that they could pay off some of those debts, you would be the one to determine whether or not they stayed in 7 or went to Chapter 13.
The U.S. trustee usually would file an objection, or perhaps one of the creditors would file an objection and, you know, raise the issue. But it comes out, what's the best way of putting it? It's sort of like a numbers decision that gets calculated before the case is even filed. So your lawyer, using the bankruptcy software, I mean, nobody does this by hand anymore, like nothing else in the world, right?
Right.
So the bankruptcy software will tell the lawyer that you fall into one of the other categories. And then at that point, you know, it's up to you to make the decision as to whether or not you want to fight it. Because some of the stuff can be debatable. It's not all cut and dried and, you know, written in stone. And you do have the ability to debate it to some extent. And, you know, if you have a good, zealous lawyer and the circumstances legitimately say you should be in Chapter 7, then it's probably fighting.
Can you think of any cases where that happened? Any cases that stand out for you that you heard?
No, well, the only case that stands out in my mind is the opinion that I wrote where it was clear that they belonged in a Chapter 13. that they should be paying back their debt. And that was the ruling. And I think ultimately they just folded their tent and dismissed the case.
Oh, okay. All right. So, Professor Jacoby, what type of problems can a person expect to face once they file? And to what extent does bankruptcy help address those particular problems?
At this point, we have decades of research that jibes with what people see on an everyday basis when they work with financially distressed families. So we can take the example of Sheila, who's in Chapter 1 of my book, Unjust Debts. She has a stable job. She's managing her finances, but then her mother gets very, very sick and needs her help. And eventually that leads to Sheila losing her job. She loses her health insurance. She uses the credit cards that have been flooding her mailbox and other avenues to fill in those gaps, truly believing that she can get back on her feet. She eventually does get another job after her mother passes, but it doesn't have the same benefits. It doesn't have the same income. And so over that period of time, it becomes clear that even if she were to try and dedicate every penny that she has to just servicing that debt, but the interest and the fees, it will never get paid back. So debt is the main problem, but the path to that often involves job loss and health problems and other such financial calamities that we know are facing so many families around the country. And there are limits to what bankruptcy can do. It cancels debt. It does not print money, no job retraining, no health insurance and the like. It doesn't offer those kinds of social insurance benefits. So for someone who's facing a chronic health problem, it may not help them. It may help them adjust to the new circumstances, but they may end up continuing to have trouble. Sometimes it's the least worst of the options. In terms of how much bankruptcy can help nonetheless, even though it can't do things other than change how much someone owes, there's a lot of different pieces and parts to it in terms of what debts can be actually canceled. There are issues with taxes. There are issues with student loans. If someone has a house or a car they're still paying for, they're not going to be able to keep the house or car unless they continue to pay. that's why the system was made so complicated back in 2005. But mm-hmm. even before that, lawyers did play an outsized role in deciding what kind of bankruptcies individuals would file. And African-American filers have borne the brunt of those decisions because they are often put in the more complicated kind of bankruptcy that does not often lead to canceling their debt at the end. That's the Chapter 13 that Judge Gordon talked about.
Mm-hmm. Well, now you mentioned the IRS. Are those debts that cannot be included in a bankruptcy case?
It depends. And the test is complicated. And I hate to leave it like that. But honestly, this is why the vast majority of individuals who consider bankruptcy end up hiring a lawyer. It shouldn't be that way. But the credit industry encouraged Congress on a bipartisan basis to make the law more complicated that it can't be figured out easily. Oh. Now, I'm sure people are doing things with AI and their other services, but as much as there have been concerns about legal representation in bankruptcy, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. the system is designed around lawyers. And that's very unfortunate, but that is where we are. For people who try to go it alone, there is research that suggests that they are more likely to have paid to get into bankruptcy because they're still paying the filing fee, but they're not getting the relief that they were looking for.
And the irony is that if you're in bankruptcy, the chances are you can't even afford to hire a lawyer. And Judge Gordon has alluded to the fact that you can either have a very zealous lawyer who can help you, or I would imagine, I don't know what the record is for pro bono lawyers. Are there even pro bono lawyers that work with bankruptcy, Judge Gordon?
Yeah, sure, there are. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say, I mean, there are a lot of quality lawyers doing this work. I don't want to sound as if we are, you know, tarring the entire profession, et cetera, et cetera. But there are a lot of problems and, you know, and in some instances, pro bono can be a good remedy for that. I'll just tell you real quick. I mean, the bankruptcy code was greatly amended. The code that we're working with now, you know, but for what happened in 2005, 2006, was created back in 1978. And that was a huge change from the code, from the what we called the Bankruptcy Act that existed before that. It was built in part upon an extensive research report from the RAND Corporation. One of the items in there that they focused on was the problem with attorney representation. Mm-hmm. So this is not a new problem. When I joined the bench, two problems were focused upon by the judges on the court at that time at a strategic planning conference we had. The fact that we had so many pro se debtors. Maryland was in the top five, I think, of national courts with respect to debtors who were filing cases unrepresented. The Central District of California was number one by far, both mm-hmm. in terms of numbers, percentage, et cetera, et cetera. But we were up there in the top five. And so that was one problem. The other problem was attorney incompetency. And just to put a period on that, from the time we started electronic filing, where you could really track these numbers in a good, you know, reliable fashion, from 2004 up until like 2015, 2016, 120 attorneys who were authorized to practice in the bankruptcy court were disbarred by the Maryland, it's now called the Maryland Supreme Court. Back then it was the Maryland Court of Appeals. Now that's a super high percentage. Mm,
120 attorneys were disbarred.
Attorneys who were authorized to practice in the bankruptcy court. In other words, you weren't supposed to practice in the bankruptcy court unless you were a member of our federal district court, okay? Then you could do it. But most of them who did it regularly were also members of the bankruptcy court. Mm-hmm. Now, I would just give a high estimate. Maybe there were, let's say, 350 lawyers on the list of lawyers who were authorized mm-hmm. to practice.
So why were they disbarred? For incompetence or?
Well, all sorts of stuff. Just use your imagination. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything from incompetence to, you know, perhaps even activities that were, mm-hmm. they focus mainly on money mm-hmm. and severe ethical violations. I'll just put those as two broad categories as to what, you know, what they focus on when they go after a lawyer to seize their license. But just imagine working all your life to get the law license and to enter into that mm-hmm. profession and then being disbarred. It must be some grievous conduct, right? And perhaps mm-hmm. there was some injustice in there to a certain extent with some, but I doubt it. The point is, I think that says a lot and is very telling about, you know, at least some percentage of lawyers, you know, who mm-hmm. engage in this kind of work. And, you know, it's sad to say so. Mm-hmm. And I think about the debtors who may have been represented by those attorneys with no knowledge at all of, you know, the level of competency or how good mm-hmm. a job they could do or not do. It's sort of a crapshoot to a certain extent.
Now, I'm sorry, Judge. If a person comes before your court with a pro bono lawyer, can you tell based on how the case is being handled?
I mean, lawyers that are willing to do that are doing it because they're good people for the most part. I mean, they mm-hmm. want to make money, you know, just like anyone else, right? But to carve out some time to represent debtors on a pro bono basis is a wonderful thing. And that was something I was very proud of. The other side of the coin with the two items that we focused on in strategic planning led to the creation of what we called the Debtor Assistance Project, where debtors who had filed pro se could get free advice from lawyers. Mm. You know, they couldn't get it extended or, you know, to represent them in the case necessarily, but at least come in and get some free advice. And maybe be steered to an attorney, maybe be shown how they could afford an attorney under certain circumstances mm-hmm. and get counsel to help them work through their case. So,
okay. So Professor Jacoby, we're sort of running down on time, but your book is titled Unjust Debts, How Our Bankruptcy System Makes America More Unequal. What else does your research reveal about how racial disparities and how can people in financial crisis use this information to their advantage?
We now have decades of research that show and find that Black filers pay more for bankruptcy relief and get less protection. And there are several pieces of that, one of which is what we already talked about, that there are two kinds of bankruptcies, and one of them takes longer and is more expensive. It has some extra tools in it, but sometimes people are put in that kind of bankruptcy even though they don't need those tools. And yet if they can't repay every single penny that they promise in that plan over 3 to 5 years, they end up not getting protection at all. There are other components of this these racial disparities, but one thing to keep in mind, it is very difficult for people to decide that they might even consider bankruptcy. People do, they sell property, they borrow from friends and family, they do everything to avoid it. The problem is that once they do get to a lawyer's office, they are close to a really big emergency. Something big is about to happen, or they mm-hmm. literally cannot do it anymore. And then when they find out how much it will cost to pay the lawyer and to file for bankruptcy, they don't have those funds. And that often leads to being put in the kind of longer bankruptcy where mm-hmm. you don't get relief because someone can pay those fees over time. So if people could at least try to get some answers to their questions earlier before they are ready to make that leap using the services that Judge Gordon talked about or otherwise, and to know that people do, the research shows that people do end up trying to save up to plan to use this important last resort, but important legal tool that is available to them. Trying to recognize these challenges a little bit earlier and doing some research or asking some questions of those who can provide some assistance would be useful. But the research is unequivocal that the system is falling short for Black families in financial trouble.
Professor Melissa B. Jacoby, law professor at Harvard and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She's the author of Unjust Debts, How Our Bankruptcy System Makes America More Unequal. Thank you for joining us again this morning on What's at Stake, Professor Jacoby. Also, retired bankruptcy judge of the District of Maryland, Robert A. Gordon, law school adjunct, and 1982 University of Maryland Carey law alumnus. Judge Gordon sat on the United States Bankruptcy Court for the District of Maryland for 14 years and is vice chair of WPFW's local station board. So we'll see you both again on March 19th for our final segment of our series, Bankruptcy 101. Thank you both for joining us this morning.
You're welcome, Vernon. Okay. I give you a quick fun fact.
Sure.
Listeners, Abraham Lincoln actually filed bankruptcy. And he repaid all of his debt over time.
Oh, so he filed Chapter 13.
They didn't have that back then. It was a long time ago. It was a different, much different from what we have now, but he did file.
Oh, wow.
Long story. I'll save it for the next session.
Yes. Well, that has sort of created a different impression of our beloved Abraham Lincoln.
But they called him Honest Abe, right?
Okay. Well, thank you both. That's going to do it for this week's edition of What's at Stake. Thanks to our guests, our earlier guest, Dr. Barbara Williams Emerson, and thanks to our engineer extraordinaire, Kalia. Next week, the Reverend Mark Thompson will be in the host seat, so be sure and tune in. Up next, Wake Up and Stay Woke, Dr. E. Fay Williams. I'm Verna Avery Brown, and in the words of Nelson Mandela, the late Nelson Mandela, it always seems impossible until it's done. Ashe.
Diversity Fund is a grassroots grant source for changemakers of color in the nation's capital. We fund social justice work by and for DC people of the global majority. The deadline for submissions is Friday, March 21st. Details and application information are available at www.diversityfund.org. You can send questions to info@diversityfund.org. Upcoming info session dates and recordings are accessible online at www.diversecityfund.org. The phone number for further information is 202-743-0130. That's 202-743-0130.
Climate Friday host Reverend Lennox Yearwood Jr. is but one of the Black voices in climate and environmental justice that will be featured at this year's Taking Nature Black Conference, March 5th through the 8th. Presented by Nature Forward and themed Reclamation and Resilience, with both online and in-person participation for connection, knowledge, inspiration, and more. Details about Taking Nature Black Conference at natureforward.org/takingnatureblack. All one word, Taking Nature Black. That's Taking Nature Black, Reclamation and Resilience, March 5th through the 8th. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
On Saturday, March 8th, beginning at midnight for 24 hours, WPFW presents One Heart, One Fight, One Sisterhood.